It's my pleasure to introduce Carol Boggs from Stanford today. And I first met Carol about 25 years ago, but it was only in the last 4 or 5 years that I've really gotten to know her. And but I certainly knew of her work. And I do aging research, but she does allocation, among other things, allocation of resources and the trade-off between reproduction and survival. And her work really, I think, brings, you can just, jumps off the page when I read her papers that there's an energy and a freshness to all of her science, and her papers are really, really enjoyable to read. Her work is grounded in the real world of field ecology. She spends time at the Rocky Mountain Biological Laboratory, but it's informed by theory. She's also made contributions, many, to the literature on both in both conservation biology and invasion ecology. She comes from Texas, and I suppose this dates her a little bit. She had a degree in zoology. I don't think there's any zoology
department. There is no zoology.
Yeah, right. In 1973, and a PhD in zoology from UT in 1979. Her current position, she's teaching professor at Stanford, a Bing director of program in human studies, and a senior investigator at the Rocky Mountain Biological Laboratory. In publications, she's published in all the name brand journals, right, AMNET, Ecology, Journal of Animal Ecology, and so forth. And she's also lead author of one of my favorite books. I had her sign this morning, Butterflies, Ecology and Evolution Taking Flight, co-authors with Ward Watt and Paul Ehrlich. So today's talk is Non-Native Plants as Lethal Novelties, Implications for Plant Herbivore Coevolution. Please join me in welcoming Carol Boggs.
So first of all, it's a great pleasure to be here, and I want to thank Jim for inviting me. Davis is certainly a hotbed of intellectual excitement, and it's always a lot of fun to be able to come up here and talk to different people and get feedback, find out what's going on, interchange, and so on. And I hope that continues later on. So what I'm going to talk about is, as Jim said, non-native plants as lethal novelties and what this means for plant herbivore coevolution. And this is not a lethal plant here. It's actually a very happy caterpillar. So we're going to be looking at what happens when you end up with a lethal novelty instead. So in general, when you have an introduced species or an introduction or some kind of invasion coming into a system, the obvious thing that you can think about is you have a change in the community structure and the community composition. And that's the initial sort of descriptive what's going on in the community structure. There can be a lot of things that you do here looking at community organization. But at a different level, you end up in differences in species population sizes, in species dynamics. And you also can end up with changes in the microclimate and in nutrient cycling. So an invasion event is not necessarily just simply an addition of a creature to the environment, but it also has ramifications that run with feedback loops all throughout the whole ecosystem, the whole landscape, from the population level all the way on through community to ecosystem cycling. What I want to do is to look at a particular case of what happens not just when you get a random invasive species coming in here, but what happens in particular if you get a species that's coming into a co-evolved relationship, which would be a subset of the kinds of perturbations that you can get from situations where you've got a non-native species coming in. So if you think about it, and you can think about this in the context of herbivores or parasites or pollinators or whatever your favorite kind of organism, favorite kind of interaction is, where you've got some kind of relationship and coevolution between the two. If the creature that's coming in is at the higher trophic level, so in our stick figures down here, we've got a situation in which we've got a new species coming in, we've got an old species that was there that was interacting with this flower. There's two possibilities. One is that in some sense the invader fits into the co-evolved system and it competes with its native relative in this case for pollinating or for some other kind of interaction, food, it could be, with the resource. The other possibility is that if this invader did not originally have the ability to exploit one of the native resources. It develops the ability to exploit the native resources. And this is the kind of thing, for example, that Scott Carroll has been studying with regard to the soapberry bugs, only in reverse. He's looking at how the natives adapt to those guys that are new. Alternatively, if something's coming into the lower trophic level, so you've got a new plant coming in here, the invader could fill the same resource role and you get diversification of the community. That's what you're studying. And the changes in the population size, potentially radiation and things like that going on. And again, what you've got is an increase in the biodiversity. And in some senses, life is happy. But there's another possibility, which is much grimmer. And that is that this disrupts the relationship initially. This creature, if it's a herbivore, tries to eat the new plant, and it dies because it's not adapted to it. Or if it's a pollinator, it tries to pollinate it, and somehow there's an interaction that doesn't work there. Various other kinds of scenarios that end up with a disruption of this relationship and the potential death of the native organism and the potential for ecological and evolutionary change. So this to me is a very interesting area to study because it's often a cryptic outcome from an invasion. You may have an invasion coming in, you get a decline in an herbivore or something like that. It's not immediately obvious that the plant is responsible. So I've been studying as a case study a butterfly and a plant system in Colorado at the Rocky Mountain Biological Lab in which we see exactly this last scenario. We have an invasive species coming in which is non-native and which is intruding into a co-evolved relationship, and the net result is that it's disrupting that relationship, and you have the distinct potential for ecological and evolutionary relationships. So it will be a story of Pieris McDonoughi and Thalaspia arvensa, which is this plant right here across a berm at Mount Crested Butte. Rocky Mountain Biological Lab is located right over the hill at the base of that valley right there where we've been working. The plant in question is Thalaspia arvensa. It's a mustard. Its common name is field pennycress. It's Eurasian originally. It's native to, looking down at the world, it's native to this part of the world. But it's invaded extensively all the way across the world. This is a representation of where it's found, plus the dots or other places where it's found. It came into North America, presumably with the first European colonists. It comes in with wheat, it comes in with horse feed, it comes in a variety of ways. It's first recorded in Detroit in 1700. And as you go across southern Canada, it shows up in all of the first Hudson's Bay botany surveys as you go across as being present as an invader. It's currently listed as a pest of winter wheat in Saskatchewan, and it's something that's dearly beloved of departments of transportation to plant as a bank holder because it comes in so rapidly and takes over, stabilizes banks and so on. On the other hand, it's a weed and it does get outcompeted eventually by native species. So it follows human disturbance across the landscape. It will also follow disturbance that's driven by, for example, cows or bear wallows or fill in the blank in this case. It's in the mustard family, if I forgot to say that. So that's the plant. The butterfly in question was formerly known as Pieris napi McDonoughi. There is very, very good evidence at this point based both on DNA and, as I'll show you, on hybridization studies with Pieris napi napi, that indicates that it really is its own species, that it really should be called Pieris McDonoughi. This is a relative of the cabbage butterfly. Its common name is variously the sharp-veined white or the green-veined white, depending upon what you're thinking about. This butterfly has been native to North America, is native to North America, and exist down the Rockies in various locations. It feeds on several different mustards that are native in the area that we're working in. So this includes Descurania, Richardsoni, which is here. It includes Cardamine cordifolia, that's an egg on a Cardamine plant. It includes various Erebus species, shown here. So there are roughly five different native mustards in our study area in Colorado that it will happily lay eggs on and happily feed on. In fact, these are those five, so Descurania, Cardamine, Erebus, Draba, and Flaspia alpestri, although Flaspia alpestri is not directly in our study site, it's nearby. And Francie Chu, as part of her thesis at RMBL, was looking for the relationship between oviposition preference and larval growth. What she found was that there was differences in larval growth rates on these different species, but the butterfly does develop on all of them. You do get successful offspring coming out of each one of these species. On the other hand, there are several introduced crucifers in the area, and they include Flaspia arvensa. The butterfly recognizes this plant as a host plant. It lays eggs on it perfectly happily, and the larvae die perfectly happily. So there is apparently a feeding deterrent in the first three instars. There's no early larval growth on Flaspia arvensa that's, generally speaking, that's successful. If you rear them on radish for the first three instars and move them over onto Flaspia arvensa, they do fine. There's not a problem. So it's a feeding deterrent that's specific to the first three instars in this case. We've repeated Francie's studies later to see whether or not there are any changes, whether or not the butterfly now can develop on it, and it's still an issue of time to death. It still can't do it. Okay, so this is the Rocky Mountain Biological Lab. For those of you who have been there, you may say, that's what? But it's the view from a butterfly looking at the distribution of the host plants across the center of the town site. So the county road runs right through here, which is why there's no plants right there. And we've got the various polygons with the various plants in here. And you see that they're really, really nicely scattered across this area. And the black is Flaspia arvensa. There is a big patch, or there was in 2000, a big patch there. But there's smaller patches scattered around in various places. And if you're a butterfly wandering in through here, what you've got, in essence, is a fine-grained environment with patches of fitness equals zero. So you've got places where you can end up and you can lay eggs, and they develop perfectly happily. You might wander off into over here and lay an egg, and it won't develop at all. So we've asked a number of questions about the ecology and the evolution of the butterfly in this system. I should say, as background, that to our knowledge, Flaspia arvensa came into the system sometime between 1850 and 1880. There was a huge influx of miners in 1879 when wire silver was discovered within 5 miles of RMBL, and we're certain it has to have been in by that time. But there was some limited agricultural and some limited use of the area by the native Utes, and if they had horses coming in, Flaspia may well have come in at that point. But certainly with the disturbance in the mining, Flaspia was there. So it's been there for at least 130 generations. So we looked out there, first of all, to see, okay, how serious is this loss of eggs to Flaspia? Are we talking about something that's really trivial and isn't going to make much difference whatsoever to the population dynamics? Or in our system, are we talking something that could be really important? So we went out and we did initially some calculations on the numbers of eggs, the proportion of eggs that we expected in the field on Flaspia arvensa versus other mustards. And we did it based on the percent cover from this map and also on experiments that we had done doing mark release recapture in various sites here to get an idea of the habitat utilization by the butterfly. So you might very well have this huge patch of Flaspy here, but if a butterfly never goes there, it doesn't make any difference. So we did an initial analysis saying, what do we expect based on the percent cover and the habitat utilization? And we expected that 9% of the eggs should be on Flaspy arvensa, and 91% conversely should be on the native plants. 9% is still a pretty significant selection pressure in this system. So that by itself was worrisome enough. When we then went out into the field and we did surveys in areas where we knew there was cardamine, where we knew there was Flaspy, where we knew there was Descurania, et cetera, and look for eggs to see what proportion of eggs were actually on Flaspy arvensa from representative areas out there, we actually found that 22% of the eggs were on Flaspy arvensa. And this is significantly more, or not significantly more, than what we expected from the 9% out there. So I think we can say confidently that somewhere between 10 and 20% of the eggs are going down on the wrong plant, which is a pretty strong selection pressure. The next question then becomes, what happens in this system over ecological and evolutionary time? Do we end up with some sort of problem where we've got maladaptation to these hosts that's driven by local adaptation previously? What's the impact of having this fine-grained spatial environment on the species population dynamics, on its evolutionary dynamics, assuming that oviposition preference or larval performance are genetically based? So these are the main questions that we're interested in this system that we've been focusing on for the last little while. So the roadmap for what I want to talk about today is, first of all, the question that almost slipped our minds, which is a little embarrassing to admit, which is it the plant or the butterfly? Maybe this isn't the same plant as it is in Sweden, where Pieris napi-napi happily feeds on it. Maybe the plant has changed in the course of its introduction into the new world, and it's not suitable as a host plant for anything that might at one point or another have been called Pieris napi. So the question is, has the plant changed, or is it something about Pieris mcdonoughi as distinct from Pieris napi-napi in Sweden, where it feeds on it very quite happily? We then wanted to look at the evolutionary potential for change, looking at the genetics underlying oviposition preference and looking at the genetics underlying larval performance. And then I want to talk a little bit about what's labeled future directions. It's actually what we're doing right now, which I think is a fairly exciting project. So if we start off by looking at is it the plant or the butterfly, going back to this original scheme, here in Sweden, the plant was native, and Pieris napi in Sweden, as I said, happily eats it. So I got together with Christer Wicklund from Stockholm University. We met in Leiden at a butterfly conference. I gave him Flaspy arvensa seeds from Colorado. He gave me Flaspy arvensa seeds from Sweden. We both went back to our respective places and did trials looking at our respective butterflies' response to whether they ovoposited on these plants and whether they would actually eat them. So if the idea being that if a plant had changed somewhere in the time of going across the ocean and spreading across here and coming into Colorado, then the Swedish butterfly probably wouldn't deal with it as well. On the other hand, if the plant had changed also, the Colorado guys might have a chance of being able to eat it. So Christer's end of the experiment with the Swedish butterflies, he had 16 females and one day of oviposition, and he had Mount Crested Butte Flaspy arvensa, Swedish Flaspy arvensa, and he added in Barbaria vulgaris because that's actually the plant that the Swedish butterfly really likes to eat. And what he found is, yeah, between the Swedish and the Colorado Flaspy arvensa, there's really no difference in their laying eggs on it. They'll lay eggs happily on either one. So there's nothing in the chemistry that keeps them from laying eggs on either one or distinguishing between the two. If he looked at rearing, He ended up with roughly 75 to 90% survival, and there was no significant difference between the Swedish Flaspy arvensa and two sources of Colorado Flaspy arvensa. There were five larvae that failed to establish, that simply just didn't get going, and that was distributed among all of his sources. So there's no evidence that there's a difference in the plant from the viewpoint of a Swedish butterfly. They treat the Colorado plant the same as they treat the native plant. So this would suggest from the Swedish end of it that it's not the butterfly, the plant. What happened in Colorado, this is a slightly anorexic caterpillar. It's not very green. It doesn't have, it's got very full. This one's got a little bit, but not much there. These are probably roughly about 2 weeks old. They're trying to eat Flaspy, and they're not being very successful at it. What we found when we tried to rear them is that we ended up with six of 638 larvae that survived to pupate. None of them survived to adulthood on Swedish arvensa in the greenhouse under the best conditions we could possibly come up with. And nine of 602 larvae survived to pupate on Colorado Flaspy arvensa as well. And there was no significant difference between the two. They weren't treating the two any differently. You die just as happily on one as you die on the other. To prove that I can actually raise butterflies, and that it's not an issue of I'm just strictly incompetent at raising butterflies, we put them on commercial radish. And 503 of 941 larvae survived. So that shows that it's not just me or my greenhouse. If we look at the pupal mass, interestingly, the ones on commercial radish come out being about 161 milligrams with a range from 97 to 202. The Swedish and the Colorado pupae that came up here, these 15, their range was 43 to 82 and 48 to 96. None of these got as big as the smallest on a native or on a normal host plant, a usable host plant. So this says these guys really were mega unhappy in this case. And as I said, none of these pupae emerged at all. Yeah?
So did the smallest pupa that was raised on commercial radish, did that pupa survive with all the
Yes, it did. It did. If you look at days to pupation, under our greenhouse conditions, it's basically 3 weeks on commercial radish as from egg hatch to pupation. But if you look at days to pupation for those 15 animals or 15 larvae that made it to pupate, it's roughly twice what you have for radish. And if you were to put this out into the field, they wouldn't have a prayer. It doesn't matter. They're not going to make it in this case at all. Just interestingly, looking for evidence of any kind of heritability, and this is as far as we've taken this, we looked at Flaspy arvensa origin. Did it come from Colorado? Did it come from Sweden? And looked at butterfly family. So is there an effect of family? We see no effect of origin in terms of time to death, which is kind of an odd metric. But nonetheless, time to death has no significant difference between Swedish and Colorado origins. But there was a significant effect of family on here. So this does suggest that the ability to kind of ooch your way through there is got some genetic basis to it, potentially. Okay, so what this says is it's the butterfly. It's not the plant. And we are looking at the right thing by looking at the butterfly's response in this regard. And this has some evolutionary implications that it suggests that what we're seeing is an incomplete separation of the biology related to regional separation, that essentially, in one area, you've got this co-evolved mutualism. It hasn't really completely separated from whatever an ancestral Pieris napi might have been, since these guys radiated from Europe into North America. There's still something about the ability to recognize this mustard that shouldn't be there, that's been incompletely separated. Suggests that we might have some selection on oviposition preference if preference is heritable, and we might have some selection on larval survival potentially. And the ecological implications are pretty severe because it says that there will be impacts on the butterfly population sizes, and that in turn could lead to cascading effects on the native plant population sizes, which we haven't looked at all yet at this point. Okay, so looking at the evolutionary potential, looking at oviposition preference and larval feeding ability was obviously next on our agenda. And we did the heritability of oviposition preference using three generations and a half sib design. These are mating cages, actually, not the cages in which they're selecting where they're going to lay their eggs, but they're mating cages for getting pairs of butterflies to actually mate. We gave them simultaneous choice between Thlaspi arvensa and Cardamine cordifolia, which is a well-used plant out there. So we're actually looking at, if you have a choice between these two at the same time, what do you do? We're not looking at, will you accept Thlaspi or not in this case. And this is work that was started with Rebecca Neal in her honors thesis. It continued on well past her because we needed to go through three generations. And Frank Shaw's been instrumental in helping us with some of the data analysis. So one of the things we were interested in was sex linkage, looking at autosomal versus sex linkage inheritance. And this is the reason that we had to go to three generations. Because in butterflies, females are heterogametic. So females are WZ. So if this green Z is a chromosome, a sex chromosome that is carrying the allele for, say, oviposite on Thlaspi arvensa, then if we had it in the F2 generation, it wouldn't be similar to its mother because it got the W from the mother. It didn't get the Z from the mother. So we're not expecting to see a mother-daughter correlation at all. It's going to be similar to its father, but its father is not laying eggs. This is a little difficult to assay. So it will be similar to its father's mother. So the Z would be passed down from the father's mother through the father to the daughter. So we're looking for a relationship between the F2 generation and the paternal grandmother when we're looking for sex linkage in this system. And it was this reason that we had to go through a three-generation kind of an effect, in part because there's no way of measuring oviposition preference in a male. Okay? So looking at this, the first thing we did was to look at the heritability of oviposition choice, simply doing a full sib analysis or a maternal analysis, looking for using an ANOVA from some of the initial standard methods. And we find absolutely no evidence for autosomal heritability. There's a huge amount of environmental variability in this system. Plant phenology makes a difference. Did you plant it in potting soil? Have you looked at it cross-eyed? You know, everything makes a difference in this case. So the full sibs end up with 0.17 plus or minus a standard error of 0.5. That is not significant. And interestingly, in this and in other ways we've analyzed the data, the maternal effect or the maternal relationship is not significant, but it's negative. So that females, if they are the opposite of their mothers in terms of their likelihood of accepting the plant. But as I said, it's not significant. Okay, so if we look using Riemel, and this is where Frank Shaw came in because he modified his Quercus program for three generations and for female sex linkage, what we find is that we do have a significant paternal grandmother effect. So the additive variance is 0.0112 with a standard error of 0.008, and the probability of that being significant is 0.05. The environmental variance is gigantic, as I said before. So that's a fairly large number in there. But we do have solid evidence for a sex-linked effect on whether or not you lay eggs on Thlaspi versus on Cardamine. So what happens in other butterflies? Is this something that's kind of a no-brainer and common, or is it something that's unusual in this system? If you look across what's known, what's published out there, Bruce Tabashnik, as part of his thesis at Stanford, estimated the heritability for coleus eurythmy for ovipositing on a variety of host plants as being in the general range of around 60%, including maternal effects. That was all autosomal. Euphydrius edetha, Mike Singer has looked at it. He's got a huge heritability, again, including maternal effects. That's all autosomal. John Thompson, some time ago, looked at crosses between two papilios, and what he found was that he had one or more loci on the Z chromosome that were sex-linked that controlled choice, and he had some autosomal modifiers. The key to all of this was some work that Niklas Jantz has done and Soren Nieland as well in Sweden, looking at polygonia, where they first crossed Swedish and British polygonia, and they said, okay, this is sex-linked in terms of oviposition preference. They then later went back and looked just in Swedish populations alone, and what they found was no sex linkage. So the pattern that we see here is a situation in which within a population, whatever the variation is on the sex chromosome seems to be fixed. And what you have left over is just autosomal variation that's determining what happens to oviposition preference. But across populations, you've got differences, you've got variation on the sex chromosome. So in some sense, this variation on the sex chromosome is defining species boundaries. And it's going rapidly within a population or within a species to fixation, and what's left over is the autosomal component. So we've been the first, as far as I know, to show sex linkage within a population in Lepidoptera for oviposition preference, and this is a little puzzling this, at first glance until you think about it as to why we did this. Like I said, the idea is that they're strong select, or that sex-linked variation responds very rapidly to selection. Charlesworth's models support this from the ideas that he's gone through, that it should be rapidly fixed, and what's left over is autosomal variation, so that you end up with this sex-linked stuff defining species boundaries. But what we're doing is we're testing this against a novel host. We're doing it within a population, but we're importing something the creature has never seen before. So it's not something that's adapted to per se to start with, and we may expect to see whatever residual effect might be, could be sex-linked because it hasn't had a chance to be weeded out of the population yet. So our explanation, our putative explanation for this is that we're seeing within population variation that's sex-linked due to the fact that we're bringing in something that's novel. So in some senses, we're crossing habitat boundaries rather than crossing species boundaries in this case. The idea here is that we also may end up then with a lack of a coordinated change in preference and performance under drift. We've got something that's wanting to lay eggs on it. The larvae won't survive. Maybe it's the plant chemistry that's doing it. Maybe it has to have something with the glucosinolates that stimulate oviposition or something like that that provides a constraint. We don't know yet at this point. And furthermore, exactly what had happened here in terms of how we ended up with this situation could depend fairly extensively on the butterfly phylogeography, because you have the butterfly originating in Europe, going across Eurasia and coming into North America across the Bering Straits is the current scenario. On the other hand, Thlaspi arvensa came much, 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 much later across the ocean with European colonists. It's possible that the toxicity of Thlaspi arvensa arose after the radiation out of Asia and into North America, and the North American butterflies were never exposed to these feeding deterrents at all. And it's something that co-evolved in Europe and has nothing to do with the history of the American species. On the other hand, it's possible that tolerance is costly in some way, and there was an adaptation that was present when the guys left Europe, And as they came across and into North America, they lost it either due to the cost or to drift, one of the two. And it's just no longer there as a way to respond to it. So those are the two kinds of hypotheses that might explain this lack of coordinated change under performance or of preference and performance in these situations. And I'd love to test that. NSF hasn't been willing to fund it. I can't get myself to various parts of Eurasia without NSF money, so that's going to have to wait a little while. So the next question is not just the genetics of the ovoposition preference, but also the genetics of the larval feeding ability. So we've done hybridization between Pieris napi and Pieris mcdonoughi, basically took the American species to Sweden because that's a lot easier in terms of permits, and then tested the ability of the offspring to feed on Flaspia arvensa. And this is, again, work done with Krister Wiklund. This is a Colorado butterfly. This is a Swedish butterfly in this case. And this is the net result. We did 23 crosses of Swedish females by Colorado males, 21 crosses of Colorado females across Swedish, so we did reciprocal crosses here. All the F1s eat Flaspia arvensa. So that means that the ability to eat this thing is autosomal, and it's also, it's not sex-linked, and it's dominant. It's autosomal dominant. We then did crosses just for controls of the Colorado plants. Everybody died. We did crosses of the Swedish butterflies. Everybody survived. So this is our initial data that suggests that it's an autosomal gene in this case that's involved with feeding ability rather than a sex-linked gene, which means that performance and preference are definitely not genetically correlated. We really wanted to do some back crosses, so we started off to get at the number of genes that might be involved. So we started off by crossing Colorado females with males that were F1s that came from both directions, and adjusting for some problems that we had with larvae diving into the water and killing themselves, we expected a 44% survival rate of offspring to adults on Flaspia arvensa, and we ended up with 38 to 39%, which wasn't significantly different. So this, again, is consistent with autosomal dominant. However, when we tried to do the other direction back crosses, where we used the F1s that were females with the males from Colorado, we ended up with no eggs hatching. We had a little bit of trouble getting them to cross at all to start with. No eggs hatched in the Swedish female by Colorado male. In both cases, no eggs were laid in the other situation. So this is some of the data to go along with the DNA data that suggests that these guys really are different species. We also tried F1 crosses. We had the same kind of a problem. Doesn't seem to matter who a female mates with. If she's Swedish female by a Colorado male for her parentage, she doesn't lay eggs. If she's Colorado female by Swedish male, eggs don't hatch. If she's Colorado female by Swedish male, no eggs are laid. So we were stymied at this point. Everything came to a halt. We can't say anything further about how many gene loci might be involved. All we can say is it's one or more autosomal loci, and eat is dominant in this case. So the take home to this point is that the butterfly is maladapted, and it's not that the plant has evolved post-invasion to become all of a sudden toxic, including to its original area that it came from. That ovoposition preference is heritable, and ovoposition preference is sex-linked. That the ability to develop on Flaspia arvensa is controlled by one or more autosomal genes. But we do see quantitative variation for feeding ability overlaying on top of that. So remember, we had days to death. We didn't have, you start off, you take one bite, your history. There is some little bit of quantitative variation there that's possible that there might be some ways to do selection on, particularly given that we saw a brood effect on time to death in this case. So this would be something to further explore in this system. So the future directions, the one that we're pursuing at the moment that we're most excited about, is work that's being done by Mifuyu Nakajima who is a research associate working with me at Stanford, who is a modeler. She's got a lot of experience doing individual-based simulation models. And we're looking at how the fine-grained patch structure affects both the ecology and the evolution of an herbivore. So if you've got a situation where you're losing a lot of your individuals to this fitness equals zero patch, is your population size going to crash to zero before evolution has a chance to occur and to get rid of the ability to lay eggs on that plant, to recognize it? So does the loss of the population happen before you have an adaptation to stop laying eggs on it, or do you get an adaptation to stop laying eggs before your population crashes? And does the structure of the environment, the structure of these patches, make a difference in how that, what happens here? So what she's done, this is an example of some of our initial preliminary output. This is, again, the map from the town site in Colorado. These are Thlaspiar arvensa patches, so right there and here and various places in red. The green is the native host. Some of these other colors have to do with habitat. This is a wet habitat, an intermediate habitat, and the white is a dry habitat. And what we have here is the traces throughout their entire lifespan of butterflies that have been let go in the simulation. Each different color is a different butterfly, and they've got probabilities of laying eggs on different plants as they encounter them. They have a given egg load on a given day, et cetera, et cetera. And all of those data come from, are parameterized with data that we have for the system itself. So it's a very realistic scenario. We've made the assumption that you're starting off with a gene frequency of 0.5, and that there is a single locus that determines oviposition preference that's two alleles and is sex-linked. So that's the underlying assumption. If you let this thing run for 100 generations, what you find is the population size. This is the mean population size out of, if I remember right, 50 simulations, but it may be more than that, coming down here. And this is the variance around it. This is the change in the gene frequency. It's getting to the point down here as you don't accept FLASPI, up here as you accept it completely. It's kind of going in the right direction, but there's still a lot of variance in here. And the trend, if things continue here, is going to be the population goes extinct well before anything happens with regard to a change in the gene frequencies that would rescue it. If you add immigration into this system, then you end up with the population size staying relatively constant, and you keep this thing right on 0.5. You end up with naive individuals coming in. But what we're doing next is we're taking this habitat and we're splitting it up in various different ways. And we're asking, since a lot of these plants are distributed due to human disturbance, human disturbance tends to come in patterns. It may be linear. It may be a big block. It may be clumped. It may be dispersed in various ways. So we're asking what happens with the relative clumpness, what happens with the proximity to natives, what happens if it's a single patch or a linear design, what happens if it's close to natives, what happens if it's far from natives. We're exploring the whole set of possibilities to see what might happen, and in particular if there are any thresholds at which you really see disasters happening from the viewpoint of the butterfly population declining before it has a chance to adapt, if there are scenarios in which the butterfly is going to adapt before the population declines. The one initial result she has looking at this in the context of distance to native and percent cover at this point, and this is population growth rate. This is in the population itself, the original thing before you perturb it. These blue dots are what happens as you change distance to native or as you change percent cover across here. And this is the response curve across here in terms of population growth. And one of the things to notice is that particularly at high percent cover, there is definitely a threshold effect going on in terms of distance to natives. So there are going to be some patterns that come out of it that are more complex and nonlinear necessarily in terms of the results as she continues to explore this space down the road. And this, of course, has implications for other kinds of systems. I mean, this is an example from Pieris McDonoghi, but you could take almost anything where you've got a mobile organism running through an environment that's fine-grained with patches of fitness equals zero, or patches of fitness equals lower even. And similar, this should be applicable with some modification of exactly where this cliff is and so on. But the general take-home principles in the end should end up still being the same. So beyond that, what we'd like to do is we'd like to look at some of the secondary compounds that are involved to see if we can't get at some of the underlying chemistry. And we'd also like to explore a little bit more about the larval feeding semi-ability. Is there a way we can put selection on these larvae and actually end up selecting in the laboratory for a caterpillar that will actually be able to survive and emerge as an adult on Thlaspi? And finally, down the road, what we'd like to do is to look at the localization of the genes that are involved in this case to get at it in a more mechanistic basis. So we're getting started on our major questions. We can say a little bit more at this point about the second one than we can say about the first one. But I think we're beginning to get a handle and beginning to get a picture of this scenario. And with that, I'd like to thank you very much and acknowledge a number of collaborators here. Christopher Vicklund has been absolutely critical. As you saw, these are students, with the exception of Frank Shaw. These are undergraduates for whom some of this work represented portions of honors theses. Miffy, I told you about, Sally Ann did a number of the GIS surveys. And these are people who helped feed butterflies over the years and helped catch butterflies for some of our background data in this system. So thank you very much. Yes, because they're less likely, the butterflies, if you think about it intuitively, if they're, right, no, but if you just think about it intuitively, ignore the graph for the moment, you've got a butterfly flying through the habitat. If Thlaspi is really close to a native plant, when it comes into a native plant, it sits there for a minute and lays eggs and so on, and then it doesn't have as far to fly to come into the Thlaspi and lay eggs. Whereas if it had a long distance to fly, it's less likely, there's more likely to be native plants in between it and the non-native, or
okay, so
it's got a longer distance to fly, it's less likely to go in that direction and actually end up there.
Okay, so the idea is that there's sort of an intermixing of...
Yeah. Yeah, so if you look at... Okay. Yeah, if you look at these things... actually, where's the original site? Well, we can do it off of here. So the red here is, hopefully people aren't colorblind. Red and green is not a good idea here. But red, so that's a Thlaspi. It's right smack dab in the middle of a native host plant. Some of these are a little bit further. This one is considerably further from any Thlaspi whatsoever. These are native plants that have no Thlaspi near them at all. So they're intermixed, but they're not in the native habitat. They're not, I mean, the actual habitat, they're intermixed, but they're intermixed in a really funky way. And so what we're trying to do is to pull that apart and say, okay, what components of the way the habitat is structured are going to influence what's going on here? Yeah.
Did you know if your Pieris population is actually declining?
So that's a very good question. The answer is yes, but why? So there was mark release capture studies that were done by Francie Chu and Alice Cummings and a couple of other people in the early 70s. And we've gone in and done, we've done some market release that I'm not very happy about publishing because it's not very extensive in around 2000. We did a very thorough one last summer. We ended up with a definitely smaller population size. And looking at the numbers that they caught in some of their particular patches previously, I have not seen anything that high in easily the last 15 years at RMBL just by gestalt. Now, that could be due to the FLASPE. It could be due to climate. It could be due to something else. It could be due to, it could be due to a Wolbachia infestation for all I know. So I can't assign a cause to it. Yeah. So, yeah, you would expect that it would have had an effect. But again, we've got migration coming in from unexposed areas. And we don't have, we have a handle on, we know the long distance dispersal, so we have some idea as to what, how to parameterize the model with number of immigrants per generation. So, yeah. Art.
I had three questions. You just asked one of them, so I'll ask the other two.
We don't have that in the field, but what we did do was to set up a situation where we exposed females in the lab to only a native plant, followed by, in various combinations, only a native plant, only FLASPE, and a mixture. And again, there were various combinations of orders and so on to see if we would get differences in the oviposition on the mixture on FLASPE as a function of what had happened previously. Yeah. Right, exactly. So this is a little bit different than Lucinda Lewis type stuff, but it's as close as we've come to it. And we see, trying to remember the data, I think we saw a slight effect if they had been exposed to one of the species as opposed to the other one first, but it was nothing dramatic.
The other question, of course, McDonoughi is a peculiar member of the NAPI group in being an open habitat.
Yeah. Although the males, there's a sex differentiation in terms of where the males and the females are. The males stay in very wet and sprucey areas. And the females tend to be much more Catholic in their habitat use, which is kind of funky.
What I'm getting at was that of the various NAPI entities in North America, this is probably the only one that regularly is physically present where there is FLASPE.
Mm-hmm.
FLASPE is a grassland step.
Right.
So the question is, do any of the other NAPIs, which might be easier to work with genetically, accept and grow on FLASPE under environmental conditions? For example, if you tried marginalis, if you tried...
So a couple of years ago, you sent me a couple of them from the Sierras. And... and they lay eggs quite happily on FLASPE, and they die quite happily on FLASPE. I tried to do it with butterflies in the Yukon a couple years ago, and what I demonstrated quite unequivocally was that caterpillars that are on plants in moving cars die. So... Yeah, so there was a number of complications there, but one of the things that we were actually doing was collecting NAPI, among other things, for some of the DNA work that Ward and Francie Chu have been doing to try to look at the whole phylogenetic relationships and phylogeographic relationships of the NAPI complex. Yeah. I have not tried Oleracea or some of those others.
Why don't you go one more question?
Okay.
Sharon had one, actually. Maybe two more. Go ahead.
I'm not sure whether Art's question might have might have answered it, but do the females spread their eggs very much?
Yes, I forgot to say they lay eggs singly, so they're not laying clusters. So they'll lay an egg, they'll fly away, they'll lay an egg, fly.
And is that spread among species?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because that could have different implications for selection.
Okay, let's go one more right there. And then we'll...
So most of the examples that I know of where recent adaptation has happened to a novel host has gone in the direction of accepting that host and performing well.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that's just a bias in the literature, or?
I think it's a bias in terms of what we can see, because if you've, well, actually, let me take that back. If you're looking, for example, for caterpillars in the field, you're not going to see them on this species. So the only way you would know that it's an acceptable oviposition host is if either you were looking for eggs and you happened to include this, or if you were doing oviposition test, preference tests. So I think the probability of actually detecting this kind of a situation is lower than the probability of detecting the kind where all of a sudden they're ovipositing and performing on it, because you've got a much higher probability of seeing it actually happen in the field. So I think there's a bias in that direction. Whether there's a bias otherwise in terms of actuality, Art maybe is able to answer that as I can, but I don't. To its end point, yeah. Exactly.
Okay, so we can follow up. You can follow up, Carol. Come to the reception here. It's a 10-minute walk. I have a map right here. So anyway, thanks very much, Carol. Great talk.
Thank you.